It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today on board, analysis from political scientists Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University. Sarah is the F. Wendell Miller Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
I assume joining us from your home, as am I. Hope you're tucked away nicely for the next hour. Jim McCormick, Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hello to you.
Hi, Ben.
We want to invite our listeners as well to join us this hour, especially if you've received your stimulus check or that direct deposit, maybe that stimulus check with the tab attached to it with the president's name on it that's been in the news. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And also asking our listeners this hour, how satisfied are you with the government's handling of this crisis? Now, that can be at a state level. Talk a little bit about Governor Reynolds' actions this week. Also, reflect on the federal level with President Trump and Congress. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. If you'd like to email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, we have the order by the president, I think expected to be signed today, the executive order imposing a 60-day halt and issuing green cards, the Senate approving that $484 billion relief plan just yesterday. Let's listen to the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. And let's go right to this point of having the president's name on the stimulus checks being sent to Americans at this time. On CNN's State of the Union this past Sunday, Steven Mnuchin said it was his idea to put President Trump's name on the stimulus checks. Let's listen to what he had to say.
The checks have not gone out yet, and the reason why the checks have not gone out is we're hoping that more people, as I said, will go to irs.gov. It's much safer to send out direct deposits. As it relates to the president's name on it, the president could have been authorized to sign the checks. That would have slowed things down. We didn't want to do that. We did put the president's name on the check. That was my idea. He is the president, and I think it's a terrific symbol to the American public.
Okay, perhaps a terrific symbol to the American public. Sarah Mitchell, what do you think make of this unprecedented move by the president?
Yeah, we've never seen the president putting his name on a check like this when we consider a comparison to previous bailouts. It was also Congress that passed the bill, so maybe it should be Congress's name on the checks. So we could talk about, this is a deviation from what we've seen in the past. I also think the delay in checks is significant, and a lot of people that I've talked to have tried to use the IRS site for checking to see whether they're going to get their bailout money. And for a lot of people, they're getting an error, right, when they try to the system doesn't know what's going on with their payment. So I think the delays are extremely problematic for people that are suffering right now.
Mm-hmm. Evidently, Senate Democrats have opened a formal inquiry into the decision to put Donald Trump's name on these checks. Amid exactly that speculation that you point out, Sarah, that it may delay payments to millions of Americans. Your thoughts, Jim McCormick?
Well, I was just curious as to how many people are really going that direction rather than having direct deposit. I suspect that some people that file their income taxes, and I think that's what they used is the bank excess from income taxes. So are we talking about a large number? If we are, that's, as Sarah was saying, that's really problematic. On the other hand, when I saw this, what it reminded me of is what's famous for politicians. They love to engage in credit claiming and blame avoidance. And I think this is really just an example, a very prominent example of this kind of effort to engage in a little bit of credit claiming for what they're doing.
Yesterday, the Senate approved this $484 billion Coronas relief package. This would revive that depleted loan program for distressed small businesses, provide funds also for hospitals, coronavirus testing as well. And we've seen earlier this week a partisan impasse that has evidently been broken over this latest infusion of federal money. Sarah, give us your thoughts on what this standoff was about. I don't know how much you got into the weeds about what kind of negotiations were going on there. For instance, were they, to your mind, working in a bipartisan spirit, or are we in partisan camps, one trying to get the upper hand in negotiations?
Well, I think what's happening in Congress is showing a great deal of bipartisanship right now. The initial stimulus packages that they passed, and then now adding more money to support small businesses. A lot of the controversy came from the fact that larger companies were taking money. And so you may have seen the Shake Shack giving back $10 million because they felt like they were taking away money from small businesses. And hospitals also were not really covered very well in getting additional funding. So Congress this time around is putting more money in for giving aid to hospitals as well.
Mm-hmm. When we talk about the party leaders negotiating these huge packages, Jim, give us a sense of what the leaders of each party are most concerned about.
Well, I think they're really trying to support their base supporters here. Certainly, the president has talked about that, you know, he's trying to help workers around the country here who have lost their jobs, you know, the 22 million people that have signed up for unemployment. But I also think even in, not on this round, but even in the earlier round, there are some kind of pet projects that really want to be supported by some of the leaders here. I mean, this initial holdout by Speaker Pelosi on the previous package, I think, was reflective of that. And, you know, and she got some things that were put in there. This time, at least from the statement that Senator Schumer has said, you know, he didn't get his state and local government addition that he initially had wanted, but he got the money for hospitals, and he got this whole question of testing, I think was just significant, because, you know, for the longest time, the president has said, even at his daily conferences, press conferences here, that testing was really a responsibility of the state. But now, clearly, I'm not sure how far this $25 million will go for testing, but it's certainly getting under the tent here on the part of the administration that I think that the Democrats wanted, because they see that this testing is really the Achilles heel in this whole effort to be responsive to the coronavirus.
If you've just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of our program. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa, both professors of political science at their respective institutions. We'd like you to join us, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you have a personal experience tied in with a stimulus check that you've received or a direct deposit. Thoughts on that? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Well, yesterday the president said he would order a 60-day halt in issuing green cards. I think later in the day, backing away from those plans to suspend guest worker programs. Of course, concerns here in Iowa as well with the workers that we have doing various tasks. Criticism from business groups fearing the loss of access to foreign labor across the country. So, Jim, let me start off with you this time. We appear to have American citizens seeking to bring their children or spouses to the U.S. They would still be allowed to do so, but the path to living and working in the country legally would be blocked for others. I'm seeing an estimate of it affecting over 600,000 people. What do you make of this move?
That seems like an incredible number to me. But yeah, that really will be problematic, because it turns out, I think, and then we have to examine this more closely, but, you know, some of these potential green card recipients, which is really where the ban has been put into effect, these may well be very skilled workers that we actually need particularly I'm thinking of the tech industries, the, some of the in the STEM area, for example. It's not that we're not training people in those areas, but it struck me if green card recipients are prohibited from some of those workers that we really need, this is probably not a very very good idea. It seems to me that this is really more of a political kind of move. I was looking this morning at some data, public opinion data on, you know, the sort of on immigration questions. And of course, on immigration questions, the parties are really divided among the public here. And, you know, to the extent of 75% of Republicans, you know, wanting to do something about immigration, to Democrats down in the 20 and 30% range here. So I think it's more of this kind of political symbolism going on. And again, it's for 60 days, whether it would be renewed or not, or whether it's just an effort to demonstrate sort of the commitment on this immigration question.
Mm-hmm. How do you see it, Sarah? Is this the Democrats calling it a distraction, a political move? Also, along with what Jim said, the Democrats saying in an effort to put blame on immigrants here.
Yeah, I think we're seeing, you know, this is part of the administration's broader policies on immigration. So I think in some ways they're using the situation to implement policies that they've been, you know, Stephen Miller and others have been promoting for a long time, right, since the beginning of the Trump administration. So on the one hand, it's just political opportunity for the administration. On the other hand, I've been really interested in what's happening with the framing of China and, you know, foreigners in terms of the scapegoating of China or others. So you see this really coming from both parties. So the Republicans and some of the commentary on Fox News, right, saying that we should ban people from China from coming in. But you also saw Biden put out an ad recently that talked discussed Trump's connection to China and how he was praising Xi. And so I think it's been really interesting to watch some of that anti-immigrant scapegoating coming from both political parties in the country.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the debate over restrictions for fighting the coronavirus intensifying this week. Many reports of protesters in some states labeling the mandatory lockdowns, the closing of non-essential businesses, the limiting of travel, labeling it as tyranny. All the while, medical workers, health experts, cautioning that lifting these restrictions too soon risked unleashing a greater disaster. Protesters came out against the stay-at-home orders to streets across the country. Here's some sound from the New York Times. Demonstrators outside the state capitol in Austin, Texas, violating social distance orders to call for the reopening of the state and the country.
USA! USA! USA!
We don't need their permission! We don't need the police's permission!
God set America free! In Jesus' name,
let us work! Let us work!
Okay, chance of let us work, chance of freedom, talks of tyranny there. Jim, what do you see behind these protests?
Well, I think there is a certain degree of anxiety, you know, people wanting to get back, you know, when you've seen so many people that have lost their jobs. But I also think that they really have to think about the health situation here and what impact that they could have. And going out too soon, I mean, I guess the better part of bravery here is caution rather than trying to simply to go forward too quickly without, you know, adequate safeguards. And I think the key will be, and what this is reflected, if we can just kind of pivot a little bit to even what's happening here in Iowa, I mean, what the governor announced yesterday, this mm-hmm. really ratcheting up testing. I mean, that's clearly going to be the key of the kind of hot spots that have to be tested. I think the real test of whether these whether we can open up our, you know, Georgia has really taken the action here as of Friday. They want to, the governor there has really unleashed a whole slew of businesses that can open up, and apparently South Carolina is doing the same, and there's been some beaches in Florida, Jacksonville, and so on. I think what we really got to see, you know, in the days and maybe week or two that follow, you know, what this portends in terms of the ratcheting up of the number of cases here. But I think the intervening variable here is really testing before you really want to go out, in terms of open up. I'm sure I'm as anxious as anybody kind of hold up here at home, and yes, probably you in your basement, Ben, are also as anxious as anybody.
Right.
You know, but I think the better part of valor here is a little bit of caution.
Right. And just to elaborate on, you mentioned the actions of our governor, Kim Reynolds, announcing yesterday that Iowa will nearly triple its ability to test for coronavirus infections. The addition, she announced, of online screening system, drive-through testing sites. So this is an effort to identify Iowans who are sickened with the virus and reassure those who are not infected, and hopefully hasten the day when Iowans, more Iowans, can go back to work. Back to this point of the protests, the political divide over this question here in Iowa. To zoom in on that, here in Iowa, we're seeing, this is reports from the Des Moines Register, some Iowa lawmakers and conservative activists have begun calling for the governor to reopen businesses and lift restrictions. Here's a quote cited by the Des Moines Register from Representative Sandy Salmon, a Republican in our legislature from Janesville. I'm not saying necessarily today, but I'm saying as she looks at the metrics, which she is doing, it's coming into sharper and sharper focus that it's time to start opening things up. Salmon, one of at least two Republican state lawmakers, according to the Register, who have said it's time for a lift here in the statewide orders, closing many Iowa businesses and prohibiting the gatherings of more than 10 people. These are closures the governor originally announced in place until April 30th. That's coming up fairly soon. Sarah, comment on this, because Iowa here is a standout, a handful of states, a lot of them in the Midwest or the West Midwest here, not having these statewide stay-at-home orders. Do you see the governor here walking a fine line successfully?
Well, I think the lack of a shelter-in-place order has been problematic for Iowa, because we have seen less of a flattening of our cases relative to other states that have implemented shelter-in-place. And I think, you know, large testing and the ability to track contacts of people that have the virus is key, right, to not only flattening the growth in the virus, but getting it to decrease. And so the danger right now, I think, is that if we reengage in our activities, then the flattening that we've seen in a lot of states is going to, you know, we're going to see an increase back up in the number of cases and the number of deaths. And I think the data from Wisconsin after voting is probably, you know, indicative of what could happen in places like Georgia. So after Wisconsin held their election, we saw about a week or so later an increase in the number of COVID-19 cases. And so this is the concern that I have, is that for states like Georgia that are going to have this opening back up, we could see an increase in cases. But I also want to point out that the number of people protesting nationally is pretty small. So I think the news media is putting a lot of attention on this. But if we look at the number of people that are protesting, it's the numbers are small compared to other kinds of protests that we've seen in the country.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you know, sometimes protests start out small and grow larger. When I've heard about these protests this week, I've recalled the start of the Tea Party movement in 2009. We remember that after the government bailout during the start of the Great Recession under Barack Obama, that bailout coming. So you, Sarah, my next question, I want to put this to Jim too, is that this doesn't feel like a movement to you? This is sort of instigated by fringe workers, fringe political activists. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think some of the activity has been traced to groups, you know, that are funded by the Mercers and other organizations. So there are certain groups on the right that are trying to organize some of these protests and using Facebook and other social media to promote that information about the protests. But I'm saying if we just look at the numbers themselves, we're still talking about a small number of overall protests.
Let's go to callers, 1-866-780-9100. I'm going to ask my producer to put on Brian. Brian calling. Where are you calling from, Brian? Welcome to our program. Brian, are you there?
You hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Thank you. Welcome to the program. What do you want to chip in here?
Well, you know, since we're sitting here talking about the coronavirus and we're throwing a bunch of money, you know, political figures and whatnot are throwing a bunch of money and stimulus out there in order to, you know, try to change things. I'd like to rewind and go back into, you know, why we're just throwing a bunch of money at things and why we're not actually taking care of the problems that have created this problem. You know, years ago, the laws and whatnot that were made have created some of these issues that we're facing right now in America, state and on federal side. But it seems like nobody wants to go back and look at those laws and change any of them.
Can you be more specific? What laws do you mean, Brian?
Well, it's like destroying medical files after 10 years. You know, people who suffer from head trauma or who suffer from respiratory issues, perhaps like pneumonia and whatnot, and who have to take medications like, say, for instance, with pneumonia, if you have to take some type of antibiotic, you know, why would you want your medical file, you know, destroyed after 10 years if you have to take different antibiotics? Because your body builds immunity up to these antibodies. So therefore, if you keep taking the same one, you're going to end up dying. So if you keep track of everything, keep track of what everybody's doing, and keep track of the medical portion of things, people are going to start getting better and whatnot. It's just like with head trauma. You know, I was a Ritalin kid, and they've destroyed my medical files. I had head trauma when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I can't find my medical files nowhere, and it's hard for me to move forward and past this because there's the laws that have been written are hindering me from moving forward in life because people are just not doing their jobs.
Okay, thank you very much. A quick comment perhaps from you, Jim. A bigger picture here. This is going to cause probably some rethinking of our health system, wouldn't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think some of the electronic securing of medical files now maybe address what he was talking about here. But certainly there's going to be a ramp up in terms of the funding for, you know, the whole question of how much CDC was getting funded here, the Center for Disease Control, NIH, in terms of its funding. Certainly that's going to be much more of a focal point in terms of the Congress now, because what is really happening is that this is really a global issue that is really affecting the domestic environment.
Okay, Jim McCormick, stay with us. Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, Sarah Mitchell of the University of Iowa. When we come back, we'll ask our guests what happens to our global politics when oil prices crater. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Glad you're on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Wednesday. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University, joining us from his home, from her home, Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. A little bit later in the program, we're going to, well, it's bound to last for weeks, if not months, the speculation over who Joe Biden will choose as a running mate. I want to have our guests think about what qualities that a vice president should have. Perhaps you'd like to join us with your thoughts, who Joe Biden should choose as a running mate if you're plan to vote for a Democrat as an independent or a member of the Democratic Party. 1-866-780-9100. Let's get to some feedback, some questions from our listeners from our first hour topics, talking about the stimulus package. Anne from North Liberty writes in an email, "We received our stimulus check last week through direct deposit. I was surprised to learn that my family of five, two parents, three children, two of them being young adults in school at Kirkwood at the University of Iowa. They will only receive money for the parents and the high school students. Anne from North Liberty says, it seems to me that the government wants to ignore the millions of kids who are still dependent on their parents, but adult nonetheless. I hope that all those young adult dependents take their voting power to the poll. It just doesn't seem fair to me, says Anne from North Liberty. Your thoughts on that, Sarah? Certainly, we've been hearing for years a lot of adult children moving back home, not moving out of the home. So perhaps Anne has an issue there.
Yeah, I think in terms of the bailout not going to college children, for example.
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah, I gave my daughter some money as a way of, because she's in the same situation. So basically she's not going to get a bailout, but I'm subsidizing her to have one. But I think the bailout, it makes sense the way it's structured, but you're right that a lot of people who are unemployed right now are in fact college students. And if they're being claimed on their parents' taxes, then they're not able to get they can get unemployment payments, but they can't get a direct bailout check.
Let's go to our phones. Veronica joins us. I'll have to ask our producer to put on Veronica, please. One of our callers, Veronica, are you there?
Hi, Ben. How you doing?
I'm good. We have a lot of listeners coming in this hour. So what is your question, Veronica?
Well, my question is, you know, in the beginning, Congress had floated around the idea of there would be more than one stimulus check. So I was wondering, is that likely to happen in May? And then the other statement I wanted to make was I was disappointed with Governor Reynolds on Monday when she said that the meat processing plants would stay open, and if people got COVID, they got COVID. You know, while I understand where she's coming from about animals and farmers, I think that was a pretty short-sighted statement to make. Mm-hmm. So,
Jim, would you like to respond to Veronica? Thank you, Veronica.
Sure. I think that it's probably not going to be another stimulus check for individuals. I think the next package is going to be, and it sounds like they're really already working it up, it's going to be aid to state and local governments and also some infrastructure money, which presumably would be transferable into jobs. But I would be surprised if there's a second tranche of money that would be sent out in terms of payments to individuals here. Now, I'll readily admit that the sort of the $1,200 and whatever additional monies you could get for dependents is not going to be long-lasting. But I think the hope is, or the expectation is, that through these various stimulus packages and through the development of testing and so on, that, in fact, can get the economy working again. I think part of the other part of Veronica's question was about closing some of the meatpacking plants, and I just noticed on the newscast at 12:30 there that apparently the Tyson plant now in Waterloo is going to be closed, which I think is a very good idea.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Join our conversation with Jim McCormick, Sarah Mitchell, our political scientist this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Let's move into an area that both of you have expertise in. You are really into foreign policy, looking at geopolitics. Monday, wow, how crazy is this? Oil prices going into negative territory. This means traders actually paying people to take oil contracts off their hands. There's this huge imbalance of the global markets, the oil markets, caused by a number of factors, including most recently this dramatic fall in world consumption. Of course, we can see it. We go out into our towns, drive around. There's a lot less driving going on. The planes are not in the air, caused by this global stay-at-home behavior. Your thoughts on what happens, Sarah, when our politics, to our politics, when the oil prices crater like this?
Well, there's a lot of really negative impacts for our economy. Global oil demand is normally is down basically 30 to 35 million barrels per day from where it was. And when you think about the fact that oil the oil industry in the U.S. is about 5.6% of our total employment. So not only, you know, people that work in the shale oil industry, but also people that work in processing that into, you know, usable gas or natural gas. And so there's a lot of jobs at stake as the crude oil prices are falling. And it's also going to affect us here in Iowa because the ethanol industry is poised to lose up to $2.5 billion this year. So it's going to have this ripple effect here in Iowa and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Jim, your thoughts?
Well, I also think it's going to have an impact globally because, you know, some countries are really dependent upon oil exports as their primary source of revenue. I'm thinking of Russia here and thinking of Saudi Arabia here. Even our neighbor to the north, Canada, you know, Alberta is going to be, it already has been hit hard, but it's going to even be hit more dramatically with this downspin in terms of oil usage here. So it's going to really have this kind of global recession effect. Now, for some countries that might have you know, some reserves available, I suppose it's an opportunity for them to maybe buy some of these contracts and so on, to buy them up and to have some oil, excess oil here. But I think that's probably less likely, and it's more likely to be case that until the global economy recovers, you know, the oil industry is not going to recover. And, you know, lots of predictions about oil producers, and particularly small producers, that are probably going to go bankrupt here and go out of business here. And that, again, will not be jobs that will be really recoverable in any kind of short term here. So I think it has that kind of domestic impact, but it also has this kind of global impact. And it'll be interesting to see what it does in terms of the foreign policy behavior, say, of a Russia, when its revenues continue to shrink, or Iran, of course, which has had other kind of problems in terms of the sanctions that are put onto them, and so it's going to have really domestic consequences there, and will it have also this kind of ripple effect in terms of the foreign policy behavior that they engage in?
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, let's move on to this. I want to talk about the former Vice President Biden, now presumed to. Presidential nominee for 2020 for the Democratic Party, but yesterday the Senate Intelligence Committee reaffirmed its support for the U.S. intelligence community's conclusion that the Russian government interfered in our 2016 presidential election with the goal of putting Donald Trump in office. Now, that was the intelligence community's initial January 2017 assessment of Moscow's influence. Now, Tuesday this week, this is a bipartisan report issued by a panel chaired by North Carolina Republican Richard Burr. Sarah, give us your thoughts. What does this reaffirmation bipartisan report do to the efforts by Donald Trump over the years now to portray allegations of the Kremlin's assistance to his campaign as, quote, a hoax or driven by the Democrats, a deep state embedded within our government bureaucracy?
Well, I think it should lay those claims to rest. So we have exactly a Republican-led effort in this case that's reaffirming that the intelligence community steps that they took were, you know, above board and what we think is reasonable, and also that what we saw in the Mueller report is being, in terms of Russia's interference in our election, this report confirms, you know, what we've already seen in those other investigations. And so, mm-hmm. you know, moving forward, I think the question is, how is Russia going to interfere in the 2020 election? So that's what we should be concerned about right now, is protecting the future elections that are coming very soon.
Right, right. And this bipartisan report also mentioning that there's no reason to doubt that the Russians will be active in meddling in our upcoming election, the campaign going on now, entering the phase of the general election campaign. Jim, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think this puts to rest, you know, the President Trump trying to claim that the Russians were not involved. And it also puts to rest, you know, his his opposition even to what his intelligence community was saying, because as early as 2 years ago, the intelligence community in their global assessment had said that the Russians were involved in the 2016 election and that they continue to be involved. So I applaud the Senate Intelligence Committee for having this actually bipartisan report come out and very strongly saying that, yeah, Russia was involved and, you know, that they favored having Trump be elected here. After all, it's widely known that Putin had a considerable dislike for Hillary Clinton here.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this final less than 10 minutes of our Politics Wednesday with Jim McCormick and Sarah Mitchell, let's pivot over to talk about the Democrats' presumed nominee, Joe Biden. The former vice president says he intends to name a panel of advisors next week by May 1st to help him select a running mate. Biden has said he will select a woman for that role. He expects to whittle down the list of contenders to two or three by July. He also listed qualities he's looking for in a running mate.
The buck stops here. Harry Truman said
not really looking for that
no
clip
excuses.
Quite yet. No,
it means
we'll get to that clip in just a moment. Biden also listed some qualities he's looking for in a running mate. First important quality, he said, someone who, if I walked away immediately from the office for whatever reason, they can be president. He also says he's listening to the advice of former President Barack Obama. That advice, pick someone who has some background or some competence that may not be your strong point, who could be trusted with presidential authority in some subject area. You've been watching the reports. Sarah, what are your thoughts on the criteria the former vice president will be mulling over here?
I think these are good criteria that he's outlined. I think the fact that he said he was going to pick a woman made the public vetting of potential candidates much easier, because the number of potential selections is much smaller. So this is a good thing for him, because he can see how the press is vetting the contenders for vice president. And we've seen a lot of discussion of Abrams, Harris, Warren, and Klobuchar, for example, and a lot of discussion about, you know, can we afford to give up Senate seats, for example, the Warren Senate seat or the Klobuchar Senate seat, mm-hmm. or what about political experience? So comparing, you know, Abrams to Harris, or is it important for him to select someone, you know, who's a Latino or African-American for the ticket? And so I think it's been a really great discussion, actually, among political analysts and the press about who are the potential candidates and what are the pros and cons that they bring to the table for the ticket.
Yeah, right. And you mentioned Harris, Klobuchar, Warren, also the Michigan governor, Gretchen Whitmer, Stacey Abrams mentioned. I don't know if both of you caught this on Monday night in an interview. I think this was a radio interview. Joe Biden was asked if former First Lady Michelle Obama expressed interest, would he be interested? And he immediately said, I'd take her in a heartbeat. She's brilliant. She knows her way around. She's really a fine woman. The Obama are great friends in that radio interview. Of course, Michelle Obama, one of the most admired women in America, as per Gallup polls, 2018, 2019. Never, though, Jim, indicating she has any interest in a vice president's position, right?
Right. She's been really quite Sherman-esque in her statement here, you know, in terms of whether she would ever accept the vice presidency here. She, as I think one piece I read, you know, sort of resents the kind of pettiness that politics and sort of the backstabbing and so on that goes around in the political process. So I think that she's probably... you know, could not be persuaded, I guess, to accept the vice presidency.
Let's hear a couple of ads that just came out. A former vice president, his campaign released a new ad that references the buck stops here. Of course, that's a phrase popularized by U.S. President Harry Truman, who kept that sign with that phrase on his desk in the Oval Office. Let's hear this Biden ad, new Biden ad that is based on that.
The buck stops here. Harry Truman said it. It means no excuses. It means taking responsibility. the ultimate responsibility for the biggest decisions in the world. Every great president has lived up to it. But Donald Trump?
Yeah, no, I don't take responsibility at all. First of all, the governors are supposed to be doing a lot of this work, and we're a backup. We're not an ordering clerk, we're a backup.
Donald Trump thought the job was about tweets and rallies and big parades. He never thought he'd have to protect nearly 330 million Americans, so he didn't.
Okay, let's juxtapose that with an ad put out by the Trump campaign. This one targeting Nancy Pelosi, it's called Let Them Eat Ice Cream. This juxtaposes images and reports of Americans suffering while showing off Nancy Pelosi's home stock of ice cream. Listen to this.
We turn now to that $350 billion fund to help small businesses and its workers get through the shutdown.
It will be up to Congress to restock it.
But Democrats blocking that move this morning.
They asked for $250 billion in 48 hours. I said, well, I don't think so. They objected, and I congratulate the Senate Democrats.
Speaker Pelosi, what are you going to share with us from your home?
Chocolate candy.
Thousands have been forced to wait for hours at food banks all across the country.
This is...
Oh my.
Chocolate, and then we have some other chocolate here. We just got to restock the ice cream.
You don't want to eat up everything all at one time.
I can't do it much longer. I'm trying so hard.
We're, shall we say, enjoying.
Having to admit that, yeah, we're starving, and
I like it better than anything else.
Taping this segment, there are 22 million people out of work.
This specific program is about stopping job losses today.
This is hurting people bad.
Other people in our family look for some other flavors, but
right now it's survival move. You don't know where that next something else is going to come from.
I don't know what I would have done if ice cream were not invented. I just wonder.
A new Trump campaign ad targeting Nancy Pelosi. Interesting, on screen, the last thing you see is the quote, "Let them eat ice cream," and it's signed on screen by Nancy Antoinette. Of course, Marie Antoinette, executed by guillotine in 1793 during the French Revolution. As we close this hour, comment on perhaps what you heard in those ads as a way of indicating where this general election campaign is going. Jim, let me start with you.
Well, I was just about to say that that is sort of the beginning of what we're going to see all through until next November. And I suspect they'll even get nastier in terms of the kind of the political divide here. But those are two pretty good beginnings. One talking about the incompetence of the, say, of the president. The other talking about the, I guess, not really focusing on what the needs of the American public are. I don't know if that's going to be the continuing divide, but we're going to see ads that are going to be as sharply focused as that, as those two that you played there.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts, Sarah?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to listen to both sides portraying the situation and who's to blame. And it's smart because the American public right now in surveys is showing that they are not satisfied with the handling of this crisis. And so this is going to, you know, be the key issue, I think, moving forward. We know that, you know, the president is going to take a hit here, right, if the economy continues to do poorly, and if there's a perception that he hasn't handled the crisis well in terms of the federal response. So I think these kind of ads are a way to deflect that criticism against the administration and put the blame on other actors, be it Congress or Obama or whoever the scapegoat is. And like I said earlier, the connection to scapegoating outside the country and thinking about is China to blame for this, or, you know, the Wuhan virus kind of language. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot of this scapegoating kind of language, both between parties and thinking about who's to blame outside of the country.
Right. And today is Earth Day. Quick reflections in a few seconds. Earth Day falling today amid this coronavirus. I guess teaching us that crises can be upon us from one day to the next, huh, Jim?
Absolutely. And let me just put in a quick
very quickly
for the origins of of Earth Day. Senator Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin was the first to do that. As a native of Wisconsin, I'm proud to say that.
All right. Jim McCormick, professor of political science at Iowa State University. Sarah Mitchell, the F. Wendell Miller professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Thank you for joining us from your homes. We're maintaining our social distance. Glad you could join us, and all the listeners joining us as well. Thank you both.
Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on the program, what's it like to be treated for cancer during the COVID crisis? Are you currently being treated for cancer? You can join our conversation tomorrow over the noon hour. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.